The Mormon feminist poet Mitt Romney for President Roadshow Farewell Tour. I'm a little confused on something.
Yeah.
Are you saying that Mitt Romney is a Mormon feminist poet, or are you saying this is a poem by a Mormon feminist poet?
That's it.
Okay, that was a little bit unclear there. Now we got that straightened out.
The secret alter ego.
Yeah, I was kind of curious to know about that. Joanna Brooks, PhD, Associate Professor of English, San Diego State University, award-winning poet. She has two daughters, Ella and Rosa, 4 and 2. She enjoys running, boxing, and learning surfing. And her favorite movie is The Ten Commandments. Her favorite book is Love Medicine. And her most embarrassing moment is losing her bathing suit when she was
10.
35?
No.
10. It's more embarrassing when you're 35.
Yeah.
Doesn't count below the age of 18. Everything you do when you're under age 18 is embarrassing. And anything after that is just life. And who's your husband over there?
This is my husband, David Camper.
David, welcome.
Thank you.
This is your technical crew,
yes.
I guess. Okay. Anyway, I'm Mark England. I'll be chairing the session. Joanna's going to speak and then entertain questions afterwards. So when you ask your questions, either I will repeat them or please come up here and speak them into the microphone so we can get it recorded. And does anybody want a zucchini? I just picked it from a garden this morning. I've got two of them. Oh, come on. Somebody's got to take it.
I'll leave it in your car.
We all know what Eloise Bell said about zucchini, right? Has everyone read Eloise Bell's famous essay about zucchini? It's August. Everybody has zucchini, Mark. No one wants more. Some of us are this big now. Thank you all for being here. Thank you to Mark for a spirited introduction. Thank you to Sunstone for having me. This probably is the largest meeting of Mormons for Obama I will ever be at in my life. Which is to say, I never even thought about voting for Mitt Romney. But last summer, when his bid for the presidential nomination began, I found myself having very intense and peculiar combination of feelings towards him and towards his bid and his chances. And I tried to put those feelings into words. And I did it in a poem entitled Mitt Romney's Underwear, which appeared late last summer in Sunstone. Sunstone was kind enough to publish it for me. And I should clarify, I'm only here at the microphone for posterity's sake so that it can be recorded. Otherwise, you know, I'm kind of a feminist pedagogue. I sit on the table most of the time when I talk to people, but I'm here. Okay, so this is the first poem I wrote on the Mitt Romney trajectory. The world will clamor, gape, and stare to see Mitt Romney's underwear. Mark my words, they will find a way to mock our Edenic Missouri, our Mexican colonies, and our golden plates, too. Mormon millionaires in insulated skyscrapers do not know. They pledge that our industry is irresistible, our destiny sure. They smile while in Washington, their lawyer sons-in-law devise broad permissions for torture. Whoever mocked the underwear of George Romney, Vietnam War opponent, advocate of civil rights? Whoever mocked the underwear of Harry Reid, Nevada Democrat? When did Harry Reid ever pander patriarchy to Pat Robertson? When did George Romney ever mug for primetime cameras and call his wife a hot babe? When our people sidle up to the religious right, I remember that good conservative Christians hold our sacred garments aloft in their stadium churches, that they picket our state conferences, that Pat Robertson calls us a cult. I remember the silken chrysalis my mother stepped into each morning, the way I learned to see the human form, the body a promise of becoming. I remember the holiness my grandmother hugged about her loins for the first time at 75. How strong She said it made her feel. I remember the sacred we slipped around her brittle bones before we lowered them into the waiting ground. I remember all that we have stripped away, our poets, our scholars, our feminists, our gays and lesbians, for the prospect of passing as good conservative Christians. Mark my words, they will tear off our clothes just to adumbrate our weirdness. They will never love our garments, knowing, lovely, modest, queer. That was my first effort. And then, as the campaign progressed, came this morning in January, where I woke up in San Diego, thank you, with two, again, strongly diametrical feelings. One, my sweet husband woke me and said, "Obama won." And part of it, whoa, it was changed. But then he said, "Mitt Romney lost badly to Mike Huckabee." And I was so angry on Mitt Romney's behalf. And so I said, angry and many things, right? Many feelings. I said, I've got to figure out, why do I care? Why do I care about Mitt Romney? You know, like, never vote for him. But I feel so protective of him. So I decided that I wanted to write a series of poems to commemorate his run, one for each primary he survived. So this has become the Mormon feminist poet Mitt Romney for President Roadshow, because I miss roadshows, don't you? So I'm in Utah. Lori doesn't miss roadshows. The Mormon feminist poet Mitt Romney for President Roadshow Farewell World Tour, because... Well, this is the only stop so far here in Salt Lake City, Utah. But I could be enlisted to read these poems other places. So just for your information. To extend the world tour beyond Salt Lake City to, I don't know, maybe Provo or, you know, Ogden would be fun. I could always read them to my eggplant plants and make it a San Diego stop too. Anyway. So we begin. Mitt Romney at 30,000 feet, and the images are a little darker than they are in the privacy of my office. I apologize, but bear with me. Iowa, January 4th, 2008. Stubble fields recede into blackness below him. Mitt Romney does not watch. His perfect hair yields as he reclines against the headrest, his visage the image of his father. Mitt holds hands with his wife, and together they face east. For a few minutes at 30,000 feet, they reach a place they finally understand. A brilliant inner room with 5-star hotel furnishings. The whisper of slipper on plush carpet, the promise of perfect comprehension. Mitt perceives beyond the tiny double-paned window of his plane a great expanse of firmament, the governments of greater and lesser lights, all spheres obedient within their proper habitations. His fingers remember the wrinkling onion skin paper of Mormon scripture. On one page, an emblem of hieroglyphics, facsimile of a total universe. Unpronounceable, comforting, the image hovers before him. How could he ever explain it? Who would believe him if he could? A map for the Egyptian dead, stolen from the tombs of Thebes, exposed with 4 mute sideshow mummies at a crossroads in Ohio. And now, millions of us, Mormons, willing to believe in a world replete with such mysteries, a sacred domain always bursting in upon these American plains. How could Mitt ever explain us? Who would believe him if he could? Are we weird? We are not weird, twinkles our telegenic prophet, as he leans into the cameras, rakishly charming at 86. We are not weird among our own. Among our own millions dressed in white, we wrestle wordlessly down sacred temple corridors. Among our own, Mitt moves in orbits of irresistible consensus like a planet. Among our own, a planet need not explain himself. But then there is the outside world, the terrestrial fields of Iowa, Before tonight, what was Iowa to us but winter quarters, the last place our pioneer ancestors huddled in huts and earthen caves, succumbing by the hundreds to consumption as they waited for a thaw, waited to shake the dust from their feet and leave these mob-infested states, to leave even the broken body of our all-too-human prophet. Tonight, amidst spectacular loss in Iowa, we see again our uneasy place in this America. 30,000 feet, and Mitt at 30,000 feet, Mitt is glad to be leaving. In Iowa, there was loose talk from cable television cameramen, ankle-deep in spirals of cable. In Iowa, the candidate circled grasping hands on stage without him. In an electric crescent of yellow light behind the high school gym, the Baptist preacher jawboned on and on about our weirdness. In Iowa, Mitt discovered, yes, that Mormons are still weird. I am a Mormon feminist poet, weird among the weird. Tonight, I am startled by how angry I feel for you, Mitt Romney, by how I pity your mechanical speech and your wounded pride. I wonder at the tenderness, for I am a Mormon feminist poet, used to being lonely in these times when our people make their worldly names as fans of war, seekers of gain, and devisers of torture. 15 years ago, our church purged Mormon feminists and poets, and yet I have remained, skulking about in the shadows, doing with or without plain water and bread. To survive, I have learned to fear the ones who look like you, Mitt. East Bench names, identical woolen business suits, a certain hardness about the jaw. I have learned to fear my own father, my brother, any man who meets in womanless rooms to make his important decisions. What is this low, bright crescent of feeling arcing from me to you, Mitt? How could I ever explain it? Who would believe me if I could? I gaze into the bottom of my cup. I see all the old, weird Mormon spirits our people have apologized into oblivion. Human prophets, tar-scarred Danites, toothless midwives wearing asafoetida bags. I see the remnant of their fabulous weirdness in the shadows of our modern Mormon lives. I can see a tender difference in our men, and I have seen its disfiguring betrayal by fans of war, seekers of gain, and devisers of torture. How do you feel, Mitt Romney, tonight at 30,000 feet? How does it feel to be once again exiled from Iowa? Can I assemble the words to explain you, explain us? What can I feel for all the Mormon men I have learned to fear? Meeting in womanless rooms to make their important decisions, my kindred, my brother, my father? Weren't we all once wide-eyed children in homely zip-front baptism suits? I wonder at our difference, at the remnant of our shared weirdness. I follow you, Mitt, tenderly, angrily, I feel. Mitt in the Field. New Hampshire, January 5th, 2008. Mitt summons a weary smile and releases the citizens of New Hampshire into the icy night, saying, "You've got some harvesting to do." But nothing grows here now. It is the 0 hour of winter. Loam sleeps under ice. Apples rest as butter. Even the maples hoard sap. Mitt cannot feel the ground freeze under his feet, his mind a whirl of pioneer slogans. The fields are white and ready to harvest. Put your shoulder to the wheel. Sweet is the work. Sweet is the work, the steadiness of the work, its unimpeachable inner logic. Sweeter routines and orderly ranks and unyielding daily schedules. The unruly land itself rationalized, a precinct, a district, a zone, a long series of doors. Mitt is Elder Romney in Paris, May 1968. He grasps a dog-eared bundle of pamphlets and summons a winning smile. He knocks. Door opens. Bonjour. Imperialists. Door slams. There is no time for Mormon missionaries. This is no time for Mormon missionaries. The city streets fill with students and strikers. Universities close. History fissures into an ironic double helix. A new epic is born. But young Elder Romney puts his shoulder to the wheel and does not notice. Born tall, born handsome, with a patriarchal look and an apostolic name, he swallows a tangle of feelings and does what he is asked. Imperialists, Mitt does not know the word. He steps to the next red door. Millions crowd the Champs-Élysées chanting, Adieu, de Gaulle. And there is Mitt, a clean-cut speck, hero of his own tiny drama. He pilots his moped upstream against history, scavenging food and fuel for stranded American missionaries. Red petrol cans balance improbably on the rump of his moped. Even as students set torches to overturn cars, even as villagers cremate their dead in Vietnam, even as the world burns. In 1968, bewildering times, 19-year-old American boys abroad do what they are told. In Vietnam, in Paris, they measure their days by the deepening wear on the soles of their shoes. The work is all they know. Sweet is the work. Sweet is the work that makes us impervious to fire and ice. Sweet is the work that gives us a secret name, a special history. Sweet is the work that redeems us from this oblivion, from the wastes of history where bodies, human furniture, pile up like barricades. Millions march the other way. Time does not bend to match the angel's speech. Not yet. Put your shoulder to the wheel. Sweet is the work. Mitt finds himself again at a podium in New Hampshire. He summons another weary smile. He cannot feel the ice beneath his feet. It is January, and nothing grows here now. In 2008, 19-year-old American boys abroad do what they are told. Somewhere the fields are white and ready to harvest. Somewhere else on the wastes of history, Iraq, Detroit, Bolivia, the body of a child burns. Mitt comes home, Michigan, January 14, 2008. You had to believe me, the handsome young son with the white shirt pushed up above my elbows. It was always my job to promise, and your job to believe me, and you did. I threw the rocks at the hindquarters of the brown velvet horse you let bareback over the tracks. I looked down at you looking up at me while the water lapped against the pilings of the pier. I did not want to go. But I did, and I held it out before me, my strange and precious thing, and doors slammed. For 2 years, you waited with my father on the brocade living room couch, with our books open on your laps, and he taught you all the things I never wanted to have to explain. In the gray morning light, I saw the shoulders of my companion, the Idaho farm boy, sloping under his thin blanket, like a burial mound. I came down the steps, and you looked up at me and held my hand in the far back seat of the great maroon Oldsmobile past the sloping hills. You stepped through to me. You looked up at me and recognized me, the handsome son with the white shirt pushed up above the elbows. You had to believe me. It was always my job to promise, and your job to believe me. And you did. I put myself before you, and you did not call me strange. I look out at you looking up at me and say, my mother and father are buried here in Michigan. But where is our home, really? The pigweed and covenant colonias, mud-rutted Iowa way stations, the Arkansas ruffian outpost where they put a Bowie knife, and my great-great-great-grandfather, Parley Pratt, storied apostle. Ancestral English forests, these sloping hills under the snow where my mother and father are buried, here, none of them, none of them, none of them is our home. Our eternal home is the moment I saw you take the brown velvet horse over the tracks. Our home is Salt Lake, where we are all married in the great granite temple in the tops of the mountains, where we become the strange and precious. I always hope to feel your reflection in the mirror of my Be Ye Therefore Perfect.
Mitt crosses the plains. Nevada, January 19th, 2008. And there's a singing part here, and if you want to sing along, you can. We waited. We knew he would shake the mud from his boots and decamp from the swampy east. For what has South Carolina ever been to Mormons but a dark spot in our Joseph's eye, the sallow, unrepentant egress of rebellion? What has the South ever been to us but the sodden ground that swallowed the blood of our prophets? Oh, we found a place that God for us prepared, far away in the west, where none could come to hurt or make afraid. And we sunk our dugouts. Oh, you can keep going. That sounds nice, though. We sunk our dugouts here 150 years ago and grew numerous as the tamarisks. We minded the muddy river flows, coaxed alfalfa from the sand, while the Shoshone and Moapa skulked hungry at the door, stealing a peek of our precious Book of Commandments. Even when Brother Brigham looked and called the place no good, we stayed on and dug canals to feed the orchard rows. Steady in all weather for 150 years, we've provisioned wave after wave of gold-seeking newcomers, stepping carefully around the foul eddies of their thirsts and fevers. Territorial outlaws crisscrossed our corner of Deseret. We paid them no mind. We poured the concrete monuments that schooled the necessary rivers, pulling power from the man-made marvel of their precipitous falls. Swamp coolers humming, we filled our pantries with desert peaches and honey the color of agates. At night, we sat out on the porch to watch bright clouds crown the desert. We paid the wind no mind. Today, the outside world will finally learn what we know when the heat mounts on a quiet Sabbath morning. Vegas is a Mormon town. The satellites, stupefied by the sparkle of casinos, now register the outlines of our Mormon dominion. A crescent arcing from Idaho to California, a corridor from Cardston to Casa Grande. Today, partisans of Zion, we will feel our strength. We count the Romney campaign signs pressed into the silty desert lanes, and we know the hands that place them there. While the newcomers steam up hotel ballrooms on the other side of town, clutching Democratic ballots like Keno tickets, we Republicans caucus like it's church, all friendliness and order. This morning, we rose early to give our Mitt his send-off. And there he was, waving and passing out donuts at the landing strip. Donuts, a Mormon food, a secret signal, a winking salute to our state of Deseret. Oh, Mitt, your smile, a bright flash on the desert. Do they see it in St. George? We're going to play a little footage for you that sets up this next poem. Maybe you've seen it. Oh. We may not have good audio. Mitt loses his grip. Florida, January 21st, 2008. George Romney never marched with Martin Luther King. He did, however, join the long, great walk against segregation when it made its way through leafy Michigan in June 1963. He did show up on time, on principle, to hold up his end of the banner, walking in time with the iron-willed crowd, wiping his brow with a pressed handkerchief. And today, in Jacksonville, the Romney motorcade is on its way from somewhere else to somewhere else when suddenly Mitt finds himself socked in by thousands of black folks. The purple-sashed women of the Eastern Star, thick-legged step dancers, longshoremen on flatbed trucks, families holding fuzzy pictures of their murdered children. There goes the MLK Day parade, and here comes Mitt Romney. Embarrassment lodged at the back of his throat, he abandons his Mittmobile. That's a technical term from the campaign, by the way, not me. He darts for the nearest knot of stocking-capped teenagers. "Who let the dogs out?" Mitt hollers. He barks. He makes radio noise. A corn-road 14-year-old tails him through the crowd. "Kiss the baby," she commands. Mitt spins and grabs the little boy by the wrist. "Look at that bling," Mitt mugs and grins. He hurls up the name of the famous basketball player. He chides two ashen-legged teenagers for being coatless in the cold. Does Mitt see voters? Does Mitt see citizens? Does Mitt see the beautiful, ordinary hands that raised a southern hog farm into a concrete city? Does he not see a people of slain prophets? A people who took the sickening crack of axe handles on their skulls, or stood 3 hours at the polls to have their ballots spoiled for dumpsters. Fence-sitter, that archaic, ugly word, ricochets about the tin room of his mind befogged by self-consciousness, his mind lost to the calculation of yields, the seeking of gain, his mind altogether gone from principles. George Romney walked at the head of the Fair Housing March. His son fools around in the mist at the sidelines. Mitt leans over the 4-year-old MLK Day queen and ogles her white gloves. Her slow-eyed mother watches coolly and waits for him to wander away. Mitt and the Last Days, Super Tuesday. In the last days, Mitt crosses the plains 2, 3, 4, 5 times. California, Missouri, Massachusetts, California. He paces the aisle of his private jet and strains at the air for a winning revelation. He hates changing clothes behind the thin in-flight curtain, a pack of cameras on the other side. He turns his back and curls his shoulders protectively around the sacred markings on his undergarments. As he slips on a crisp white shirt, Mitt practices a joke to impress the troop of reporters. When he steps from behind the curtain, dressed, Mitt always flubs his lines. In the last days, Mitt leaves the campaign trail to mourn our telegenic prophet. Mitt is the candidate enfolded among the brethren, genial in mourning, confirmed in their identical woolen suits by the warm kiss of satellites. Sitting before the cameras, Mitt remembers his mother, laid out so lovely in her chaste white dress. He remembers his sons standing waist-deep in the Ward House baptismal font, each in a homely white zip-front baptism suit, each waiting his turn to be buried in the water. In the last days, Mitt stands before a crowded 4-star hotel ballroom in Massachusetts. Towers of comfortless cells rise above him, the beehives of counterfeit empires. He steps to the podium. Disappointment bleeds across the United States maps on the giant television screens. Mitt's wife looks up at the screens and says, "Nothing is clear." Mitt tells the crowd his wife is wrong. Mitt tells the crowd America is the hope of the earth. confetti drops. The faithful do not want to leave the emptying ballroom. They gaze up at the bright outlines of Utah on the network television map and think of home. They grip elbows. They tread circles like oxen in a sweep. Outside the hotel ballroom, the Salvadoran janitor hums a cumbia and waits her turn. And finally, Mitt drops out, or What is Lovely About Us? Washington, D.C., February 8, 2008. While you brace yourself at the podium, calculated and bellicose in defeat, I cringe at the tinny noise of your speech, and yet I feel for you still, Mitt Romney. We have all watched you work like an ox, dragging the strange leaden handcart of our history back and forth across these United States. We have winced at the public talk of planets, plural wives, and boyhood angels. Stiff, stolid, graceless, you never knew how to explain yourself or us. I do not blame you, Mitt, for trying to manage our weirdness with rhetorical calculations. Nor do I believe you when you sell your simple failure as an act of wartime patriotism. I hate that you bray on bravely about terrorists and make yourself ugly in all the ways a small room of conservatives would applaud. Yet, I still own you, for again I feel a low, bright crescent arcing across the canyons of our difference, and I know its name is love. For weird as it sounds, I love you, Mitt Romney, the way I love every Mormon I have ever met, for the sake of the history that stands between us. I love you for the tabernacle we share, its sky dome seen by rawhide and horsehair, pine columns reverently painted after marble. I love you for the sake of my inelegant pioneer grandmothers and all the callous tongue scourgings they bore from simple men who feared the trunks of magic teas they dragged with them to Zion. I love you, Mitt Romney, the way I love my brother through the 2 years he knocked trailer doors in Missouri, land of the mobs who killed our prophets, their great-grandchildren still asking, eager, is it legal for me to kill you? I love you the way I love all the flaxen-haired 19-year-old boys who knock on my door, and I open it wide just to hear them say Parowan, Kanab, Hurkin, and Colville. I love you, Mitt Romney, the way I love my brother, the way I love my father, despite his calcified pulpit speech, despite the hardness in his jaw, his granite brow, a bulwark against his better feelings. I love you, Mitt Romney, and yet what is lovely about you? If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. But what is lovely about fans of war, seekers of gain, and devisers of torture? What is lovely about those who would trade our tender differences to profit from a worldly and warlike same? What is our place in these United States? Who believes that we deserved ourselves into this glimmering prosperity? Where is the hope of the earth? And what is lovely about us? These are hard questions, Mitt, but there is no meanness in my asking them, for I am a Mormon feminist poet. I wake up every day in a grove of hard questions, and I go to sleep every night on a starlit plain. It has been 15 years since our church purged its feminists and poets. I have been angry, and I have been afraid, but I have not allowed my love to desert me. I have hidden myself in the cottonwoods, in the Red Rock, by the Red Rock Canyon River, doing with or without our plain water and bread. I have wept, and I have remembered, but I have not allowed my love to desert me. My love has brought me here. This is my hymn to banish fear, to name and celebrate the tender differences I have seen in our men. This is my hymn to proclaim what is lovely about them. And I say, lovely is the man who honors the gorgeous tangle of his feelings. Lovely is the man astonished by angels. Lovely is he who abandons the failing timbers of his father's roof. Lovely is the one who washes his garments in the waters of faraway rivers. Lovely is he who walks the colicky baby, his Sunday socks thin against cold kitchen floors. Lovely is our great historian, the exiled keeper of memories, asleep alone on his mother's couch, his fingers dreaming the touch of forbidden papers. Lovely is the one who lifted the curse of Cain from this church, he who ushered in through the torn curtain of his vocal cords a new dispensation. Lovely is the kind one, the patient one, the gentle one, the one unafraid of hard questions, the one who knows the history of his people. Lovely is the weird, wide-eyed child inside all of us, homely in a zip-front baptism suit. Brother Mitt, your run is over, but my poems, like sturdy little ox carts, go on in search of our lovely Deseret. Thank you. Well, I'll take a standing ovation even from a very friendly room.
Well, let's open this up for questions at this point. I'm going to start off by making one little comment. I won't be able to be at all session where they're talking about the Romney campaign. I just want to say Mormons should be incredibly grateful that Romney did not win, not least because his politics and policies were rather un-Mormon, but if he had been president, or let's just think about it this way, if George Bush was a Mormon, it would have destroyed the missionary effort throughout the world. Since Romney patterned himself after George Bush, we can only anticipate he would have acted the same way. But just being president means he represents the United States, and I don't know why Mormons would want that confusion. Any Mormon president, even if he was a good Mormon president, would still seriously undermine the missionary effort throughout the world. But anyway, that's my personal comment. And I never could figure out why anyone considered that I talked to. Anyone have any questions? And if you'd like to ask a question, either come up and ask on the mic, or I will repeat your question so it's recorded.
I'm going to go sit in front like the teacher.
I think the first question from the whole room is, how do we get copies of these poems?
Yes. I don't have a plan yet, but I will develop one. I'd like them to go. So I'm working on a book of poems, and this is one section of it, but a book can take a long time, so I think I need to devise something more quick. Maybe online publishing. I don't know. I'll have to figure the answer out. Thank you for asking.
Don't you think you were too idealistic about Romney to begin with? You followed him as governor. He's a flip-flopper. I know he was a phony when he ran for governor of Massachusetts. He didn't believe half of what he was saying. He said to the Kennedy, in the Kennedy debate, "I'm just as pro-choice as you are. I'm just as big a gay rights." We knew that was BS. Let's
for history's sake, we'll repeat the question. It was more tied to idealistic. He was a flip-flopper. See, it's that flip-flop I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. You know, that he's the son of George Romney, right, who was a Democrat. His mother voted pro-choice in the Michigan State Senate, right? And then he proceeded, he's kind of a modern sort of, and then that dramatic refashioning of oneself to comport with the politics of good, this calculated appeal to become on social issues what a good conservative Christian would vote for, that I felt mirrored, right, a similar turn in kind of our own church at a historic moment, there was a narrowing and a refining of our collective political profile. Does that make sense to the rest of you? Yes, right? That it was possible to be George. It's still possible to be Harry Reid, but he's a convert, That was happens to her. But that's what I think part of me fascinated was this flip-flop. And Judy Dushku has an online interview you run across with some random like reporter from New Zealand, where she talks about witnessing this. She knows him, you know, and witnessing this change in him. I'm interested in that.
On the issue of flip flopping, I think that's a quick turn. And it's always bothered me because what would life be if you couldn't mature in your judgments and try to develop and grow and say, well, I was wrong there? Then I'm progressing in my thinking. So it's always bothered me that they no sound bites have to be short, and it really troubles me. I mean, this isn't really under poetry, and we can get into political, and maybe we should do that later. But I really appreciate your guest in writing. I'm from Alabama, and in Alabama, a lot of what you were saying is how the people embrace Tucker. They go, and which I think John McCain was thrilled with, because then, you know, it divided the vote. But Huckabee is one of the South's own, and they could embrace him. And it's very similar.
And that was fascinating to see, you know, in the Romney campaign, and if you saw, like, the stats from Super Tuesday, you can see, you know, Romney does well on the left. We have it. We watch this as Mormons knowing. We watch this as Mormons knowing that this is this residual Mormon geography, you know, and feeling, even someone like me who does not identify Romney, feeling a sense of pride and ownership in that. I mean, this is our lovely, this is our dominion, right? Vegas is a Mormon town. Who else knows that when they drive through but us, you know, so... You know, that's fascinating to me, is like the way it maps out into a Mormon sense of place and a political sense of place.
I'd like to make a comment sort of like Mark's. I really wouldn't, I'm still worried that he might be chosen as a vice president candidate. Because
we really get from my end of the world.
But I can't imagine why the church would want to set up a kind of symbolic picture of a Mormon versus black president. It just seems to me that the Mormon church could not, it would get so defiled by that they would ask him not to accept the vice president.
They could do the right thing and excommunicate him.
I'd like to go in a different direction. I just want to thank you, Joanna. It was, your poems were really touching. And they reflected so much of what I felt. I mean, I don't like Romney's politics either, but I find myself being so protective of him.
Absolutely.
And caring so much about the Mormon issues, which made me realize how much all of this means to me. And your poems so beautifully express that. They're so eloquent, they're so elegant, so evocative. And, you know, the way that you use Romney as a metaphor for our place in this American nation and the way in which we fit and don't fit, I was really, really touched. And thank you very much. To me, that is the important thing here. You're exploring our Mormon identity in a way that I think is extremely important that we need to do more of.
Maybe we'll put them up on the Mormon Women's Square website.
Great place.
I don't know how Mitt Romney feels. There's no question about the fact that he's been very expedient in what he's done politically. But I find myself really questioning of what this fellow said to begin with, because I have a gut feeling, which may be totally inaccurate, that he's far, that when he ran for Massachusetts governor, he was far more, he was showing his true colors, that he was far more liberal than he finally become. That running for president, he did far more expedient things than he did when he was running for Massachusetts governor. because of the liberal nature of his parents, who served liquor in their home. I ran into him during the Olympic years in an R-rated movie, and I thought to myself, way to go, man. to assume that we know what's inside his head when he ran for governor of Massachusetts, I think is really something to question.
My guess is
that he's more liberal, not more conservative than we think he is.
Well, I think it's, I tried to get at it in the Mitt Loses His Grip poem, because I think the word used that I like is expediency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that, yes, he was raised in this kind of household where there was this kind of liberal sensibility and even liberal politics, right? Committed liberal politics. And he kind of just goes along with that, but he does what he's told. He does what he's told, right? And so by the time he arrives at, a decisive moment, an adult moment, his principles aren't in place in terms of political principles, liberal, he can't go, you're walking around like an idiot. You're not, at this Jacksonville MLK Day parade, you're not talking to anyone over 16 years old. You're not reckoning seriously with what it would mean to be the leader of a country that does include millions of African American people, and that your charge would be to take their interests, good governance, right? Yeah. Dignity. This is what's been sacrificed to expediency, is what I was trying to get at. And so he's fooling around in the midst of this island. George Brown began to show up, and he had to march, right? He had to march. It was the right thing to do, and that sense is gone. And part of that, I think, comes from the business background and the seeking of gain that I tried to reference to. Like, what happens when your mind is trained to think for decade upon decade only in terms of extracting a yield? That is his specialty, is extracting yields at any cost, right? Pretty much.
Well, there's no doubt he should have ran for governor of Michigan if he wanted to be a moderate and hold his true ideals. But it's like a political guy on Fox, Dick Morris, says all the time that if you flip-flop once or twice, the public forgives you. When you flip-flop three or four times on tobacco taxes, stem cell research, abortion, gay rights, the public knows you're a phony and they know you're going with the thing. And so he is every bit as conservative as George W. Bush. He's not a moderate like his dad. Bush's dad was a moderate and a pretty good president. Mitt would never be as good as his dad was, not even the same league.
There's a lot of certainty in that
tone. I'm a political junkie.
It seems to me that sunstone isn't about certainty.
My sister has a comment.
I don't know how to quite express, but I appreciate greatly the holding the breath feeling.
Get these comments on tape.
Oh, my sister on this trip.
I'm embarrassed. I never say things right. Let me regain my thoughts. Just that holding the breath feeling of seeing someone that could quite possibly be to all of us a father figure, which you did touch upon. A lot of our fathers wore the white shirt, stood for things generationally, were this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And as we all hold our breath, as they go out to be exposed.
Yeah.
And just also feeling that sense of pride because they are good, but also those things. Fearful that some things that are sacred to us could be misconstrued, and that sound bites, albeit too short, can be, make them look ugly, and at the same time showing love for him. And it doesn't have, this poem didn't have a lot of interest for me on the political things that were going on as much as that relationship.
I'm interested. I loved your poems, and they were moving to me. I'm trying to put Mitt in a place where, is it the politician, or how is he different from other politicians? I don't think he is. I've never known a politician who did not flip-flop. I think the whole reason for politics in the first place is to compromise, because we have the right and the left, and when they come together and compromise, we get something done. So I've never known a politician who didn't flip-flop in order to compromise. So I'm conflicted somewhat by some of the things, and I like your satire and so forth, and I wasn't offended, but I do have a soft spot in my heart for any person who goes into politics and tries to do something and is trying to do it without, you know, without being a politician. But I thank you for your poems, and they're beautiful. And may I ask a personal question? Are you a Brooks by birth or by marriage?
By birth, but I'm not from Ronnie Brooks.
Oh, my goodness.
not that I know of.
I thank you.
Thank you. I wish I related Ronnie to Brooks.
I'm amazed why anyone would want to run for the presidency. It has to be the ultimate ego trip to think you can lead a people, but there has to be someone to do it. And when I look at the candidates that we have, Obama and McCain, who knows who they will pick for their mate, running mate? They are. Obama knows very little about foreign policy, and McCain can't even email. So, you know, they don't walk on water, and you just have to pray for whoever's up there, and that would be true. Mitt Romney chose to go the same route, and authenticity is what the American people are looking for, and sincerity, and it's hard when you have that great ego that you want to win and have people vote for you. So I appreciate what your efforts were. I listened with great care when Mitt Romney gave his speech, and the reaction to it on him trying to explain what his religious values were. And I say, God bless America.
Mine's about the mechanics of your writing and your performance. I just have a question about the mechanics and the writing. You know, some poems are really fun to read. They just flow, like as Robert Frost said, ice, you know, flowing on a hot iron. And your poem's like that. And it seems like just a joy to deliver. And so, like, how do you write it? I mean, are you writing with that oral tradition in mind? Because lots of contemporary poetry isn't. And I assume you write it on a computer, but then you walk around reading it to fix it. So
you asked the dream English professor's question. Place your poem within the canon of American literature, which I know. I write snatches of time, you know, because I have small kids and a job, you know, so early in the morning or on a Saturday morning when David, like, holds the buffet in the other room. No, this one I dedicated work time to, and I would sit down and write. And I researched a lot for this poem,
yeah,
something I don't usually do.
Yeah.
And I researched, like, Mormon history in Nevada, and I researched, like, all the things he says in this poem, he said. It's like, from the New York Times to your ears, really, you know. So I researched a lot, and then I let it gel around. And that orality, you know, one of the things I wanted for these poems was for them to be big poems. A big series of poems about what Margaret was referring to, Mormon experience in contemporary America. Because I read Mormon poetry, I'm a lover of Mormon poetry, and a lover of Mormon poets, but I think sometimes our horizons are yet small. We write mostly in the confessional vein, in very circumscribed spaces, not knowing quite how to incorporate all the mass of the oral tradition of our people and the rhythms of their speech. So I was thinking consciously of trying to do that bigger kind of poem that just eats up, you know, big chunks of Mormon orality, and the tries to sound like Mormon is my sound in the Nevada poem, although not really, but, you know, so yes, that was conscious. And my main thing always, though, in delivering it is trying not to cry. You know, we're habituated rhetorically from a young age to sacramenting, just having the punctuation. But usually it starts out as just, actually, one more thing I want to say, I know the room is hot and our time is over, but my first round of readers of these poems were all non-Mormons, because, you know, critical mass for Mormon poets, you know, good luck, you know, especially if you're living in the colonies, you know, like, good luck. And wanted these to be poems that would speak emotionally to non-Mormon people, too. And one of my dear non-Mormon friends, who is a writing partner of mine, who is African-American, read the first draft and said, I really need to understand more. She's like, these are beautiful, these are moving. And that's when I came back and really filled in all the stuff about placing it in the context of, this is 15 years after the Purge, which has defined my relationship to Mormonism. I mean, I was 21 or 22, right? So, you know, and coming to Boise again and coming back from the wilderness to try and deal with why do you still feel, and the feelings are still there. So a lot of that kind of frame I called back into place when a non-Mormon friend nudged me gently and said, now come on, really look at your feelings on this. So I thought that was important to add. And that there is a receptive audience to our experience. Yeah. Thank you all for coming.